It's my pleasure next to introduce Dr. David Hemenway. Dr. Hemenway is a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. He's an economist and health policy expert. He's the director of the Harvard Injury, I told you this was an all-star group, but the director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He's the author of a number of books about violence and injury prevention, including, let me see if I can get this right, Private Guns, Public Health, which is a wonderful and clear summary of the research in this area, and we're just very happy to have David here today.
So I have nothing to disclose. What I thought I'd do today is do three things. One, since this is a law section session and all of us are in the injury section, I thought I'd quickly sort of explain to you where we're coming from. Second, I'm going to talk briefly about manufacturers and then about distributors. So people always talk about the public health approach. What we're really trying to do is prevent problems from occurring, not waiting till somebody shoots somebody else, but going upstream as far as possible. It's a population-based approach, not about individuals. When I talk, for example, to psychiatrists, one question I often ask is, why do you think there are so many more suicides in Arizona than in Massachusetts? And the good answer, basically, by psychiatrists is, that's interesting, we didn't know that, and they shouldn't, because what they're interested in is one-at-a-time medicine, and we're interested in populations. Then they suggest, well, maybe there's something about the sun that makes people more depressed. And the answer is, there seems to be no difference in terms of depression or mental health or suicide ideation or even suicide attempts across these states. The big difference is gun availability. The public health approach we'll talk is a systems approach. It's broad and inclusive, trying to get everybody involved, and including the gun community. And this really is not blame unless blame helps prevention. We're not blaming guns. We're not really blaming anybody. What we're trying to do is prevent. And to understand the injury approach, I think you have to understand the iconic story, the just-so story that people in injury, that we sit around the campfire and tell our young. And this is the great public health success story in motor vehicles. What happened there in the 1950s, we were told, I was told that over 90% of crashes were due to driver error. You had stupid drivers and tired drivers and so forth, and over the majority of driver deaths, of motor vehicle deaths, were caused by drivers deliberately breaking the law, running red lights, speeding, and of course drunk driving. So what should we do? We ought to do something about the driver, since it's all their fault, enforce the traffic laws, and educate drivers. And so, like, I had to take driver's ed when I was in high school, as all my contemporaries did, and what we learn now is what driver's ed tends to do is have nothing to do with fatalities, but lets kids drive younger and die sooner. It wasn't until the 1950s that public health physicians asked a different question, not who caused the accident, but what caused the injury. And there, it was clear people were being speared by steering columns that didn't collapse. Their faces were lacerated by windshields, which were not made of safety glass. They were thrown from the car, and they died, or the engine would come right into the passenger compartment. They would lose control of the car for a second and go off the road and hit trees and lampposts, which were planted along the sides of the roads. No one we know has ever lost control of the car and gone into a field and died. We were not planting lampposts along the sides of runways and for airplanes. And people began saying, can't we make the cars safer? Can't we make the roads safer? Can't we do something about the emergency medical system? So fast forward 60 years, and what we find is nobody really thinks, no expert thinks, the drivers today are better than they used to be. We're better about drunk driving, worse about distracted driving, and yet fatalities per mile driven have fallen over 85%. Of every 20 people who would have died when I was young, only 3 die now. Why? Because the cars are so much safer, the roads are so much safer, and the emergency medical system is better. And so the key insight that was pounded into public injury professionals is that you don't have to change people to make a difference in injury and violence. What you really want to do is create a system where it's hard to make mistakes. So you're driving along the highway in California and you're tired and you're actually moving because it's late at night, and you sort of doze off and the car leaves the lane or is about to leave the lane and, oh my goodness, you're at fault, you're going to kill people, da-da-da-da, and what happens instead is bum, 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 you hit bots, dots, which waken you up and say, get back in lane, you idiot, and you do, and nobody gets hurt. You want to create a system where it's hard to make mistakes, a system where it's hard to behave inappropriately. People are speeding, and they're going much too fast, and they're endangering pedestrians. Instead of having just cops every place, what you can do is change the road. You can put in speed bumps, or you can change the configuration of the road with chicanes or neckdowns. It turns out there are 24 different ways of traffic calming, all of which will save pedestrians without any enforcement at all. So the key thing that we want to figure out to do is we have lots of motor vehicles. We're slowly learning to live with them. We have lots of guns in the United States. 20% of the adult population owns guns, and they're going to keep their guns probably no matter what. So we have to start learning better to live with guns. And two ways to do this is to change laws. One of the things we've learned in motor vehicles is that the manufacturers only responded when they were forced to. The reason we have seatbelts is because they were forced to put in seatbelts. The reason we have airbags is there was a 20-year struggle against the manufacturers to try to put in airbags. Now they do much better in part because we have good data systems, not only about fatalities, but about how safe cars are, which are mandated by the government. A second thing to recognize is that it's really important to change social norms. The big social norm that was changed in driving, of course, is about drunk driving. Now, let me talk briefly about manufacturers and then about distributors. What we know about manufacturers is very little. I'm an economist, and this is an industry. It's really hard to get information. Most of these companies are privately held. But this year, an economist at Small Arms Survey did this long, long, long report, which I'm going to summarize in 1.5 minutes. In the last 25 years, in terms of the U.S. market, there are about 6 million guns per year manufactured and sold, new guns in the U.S. market. About two-thirds are domestic. The foreign imports have been increasing over time. 2009, 2000, through 2012, there's been an increase in the total over 6 million. This is a manufacturing market which is really segmented into four parts: shotguns, rifles, revolvers, and pistols. The huge majority of manufacturers just go in one market of these four markets. There are about six large manufacturers that are in all of them. Over time, we've had a big increase in imports, particularly for pistols. And this is a market which is hard for manufacturers because it's very highly cyclical, not following the business cycles, but following political cycles. And it's really the pistol market which is the most cyclical. Of these four markets, just to give you a feeling, in the last 25 years, the shotgun market's been a slow decline over time. It's a stable duopoly. These two firms control over 80% of the market. The rifle market has had steady share sales. It's a stable oligopoly, meaning four firms have typically over half the market share. The revolver market, like the shotgun market, is in slow decline. It's a stable oligopoly with about four firms having over 50% of the market. And then the pistol market, which is by far the most interesting, semi-automatics, it's been a big increase in pistol sales, highly volatile market, going up and down and up and down. Imports have really taken over. It's an oligopoly, but very unstable oligopoly in the sense that there's now a lot of new imports, which are now among the top four or five largest manufacturers. What can manufacturers do that they don't currently do? And the answer is lots and lots of things. It's incredible how much more they could do to prevent the problem. One of the things we know in terms of reducing crime, that it's very difficult to trace a lot of guns. One of the reasons is because some of the serial numbers are obliterated. Why are they obliterated? Because it's so easy to obliterate the serial numbers. We should make it so it's manufacturers are forced to make serial numbers which are hard rather than easy to obliterate. Of course, we want to have manufactured guns so that we can trace the bullet not just to the make model but to the exact gun, and it looks like we should be able to do that, and some states are now requiring that. That makes CSI Miami shows probably less interesting, but we are able then to find criminals. Manufacturers that do a lot better at preventing accidents. I think 15 years ago at the American Public Health Association meetings in Indianapolis, at a restaurant, a local reached down to pick up something out of his pocket, dropped the Derringer, it hit the ground, bang, it went off and shot two female delegates from the American Public Health Association who had to be raced to the emergency room. We have guns in the United States that when you drop them, they can go off. This is unacceptable. You shouldn't have these. We'd like to have childproof guns like we have childproof aspirin bottles. We know every day in the United States, many teenagers will find their dad's semi-automatic pistol. They'll play with it, they'll take out the magazine, they'll think it's unloaded, it looks like it's unloaded, and they'll pull the trigger. And sometimes, like every day, they shoot somebody. Often their best friend, and we can blame the kid, we can blame the parents, or we can prevent the problem from happening at all, which is force manufacturers to make semi-automatic so when you take out the magazine, the pistol won't shoot. Manufacturers can do a lot of things to reduce theft, which is the principal way, a principal way in which guns get from the legal to the illegal market. One way is personalized guns. Years ago, my car radio was stolen. The next car I bought had a little sign on the window that said, you can steal this radio, but it won't work. And that's what we want for guns. Over the last 20 years, there's been a real decrease in crime, not only in the United States, but across the Western world. Nobody quite knows why, but in the area where there's been the largest decrease in crime is auto theft. And it's clear why that is true. It's so much harder to steal cars than it used to be. It's not because kids are nicer than they used to be. There's lots of things the distributors can do. One of the things that we were sort of pushing is that in order to reduce straw purchasers, there are some distributors who do a really good job trying to figure out who's a straw purchaser, other distributors who don't do a very good job. And we want everybody to be doing the good job. In Massachusetts, 10 years ago, it was really easy for a 19-year-old to go to virtually any alcohol establishment and buy beer. Now it's almost impossible because everybody is being forced to card every 19-year-old. They caught up to now age 30 because someone has read then the Riot Act and they better do it or they're going to lose their license. And what we really want to do is for gun distributors to have the same kind of change. Let me talk briefly about Massachusetts. After the Sandy Hook shooting, there were large numbers of bills put forward, and the Mass Speaker of the House asked for an advisory panel. There are seven of us on that advisory panel, four gun owners, and then myself and two other people who are not gun owners. Massachusetts, we do great. Here we are in Massachusetts. We have the third lowest rate of household gun ownership, the third strongest laws. You need a license to buy and so forth. We have police discretion about who should get the license. And we have the third lowest rate of overall gun death, the second lowest rate of gun suicide, the second lowest rate of unintentional gun death, and the lowest rate of gun homicide among the urbanized states. Gun dealers in Massachusetts are required to do a lot of things. One of the things we do, no one else does, is we force you to sell out of your storefront rather than out of your backyard. There's lots of things we do. One of the things that's interesting is that this committee, I keep pushing, why can't we have manufacturers and dealers do? We meet with all these people. We have not met with manufacturers or dealers. None of the bills have anything to do with manufacturers or dealers. One of the things that we don't do in Massachusetts is to require employee background checks, which we ought to do. The owner is required to have a background check, but not the employees. There's no requirement for background checks on private sales. Talking to gun dealers, I found that one of the things, for example, is the federal government requires that every handgun, not long gun, be shipped to the dealer with a lock. In Massachusetts, what a lot of the dealers do is that they take that lock and they take the handgun, they sell the handgun, and over on the other side, if you want to buy a lock, you can buy it, but they don't sell them together. And it's like, what's going on? This is not what we want. We're supposed to have annual inspection. We do not. It would be nice if we really did. Finally, what I want to argue, and then I'll stop, is that what we're trying to do is change social norms. There's so many norms that ought to be changed. This is an important way to do things rather than just changing laws. We're working with gun dealers, gun rangers, gun trainers, working with the New Hampshire Firearm Safety Coalition, doing lots of things that are going to help save people that the gunners are happy to do. For example, gun dealers. There was a gun dealer in New Hampshire where in 1 week, three people came in, bought a gun, and within the day had committed suicide. And it's like, nobody likes that. We could figure out a way to make it so these dealers don't sell to people. Somebody comes in, no interest in guns, doesn't care which gun she buys, doesn't want to know about how to clean the gun, and says, I don't care how many bullets as long as there's one. It's like, maybe you don't want to sell to that person. And the gun dealers are saying, that's true. We're going to try to figure out ways to do better. And finally, I'll say this, is that this is an area as a whole is in which we know very little. Huge amounts. You've heard a lot of the good work done by Daniel and Jan. That's the good work that's been done. I mean, there's less than a handful of people who are doing this good, important work. And this is an area, the gun area, we have a huge, huge problem in the United States, and we need people to do more research in this area. So anybody who is interested, please join us. Thank you.